Welcome to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series. I'm only hesitating because I'm checking the microphone volumes, and they seem to be fine. So this is episode 36, back in the Shambles Cottage Studios. I'm still reeling a bit from last week, Stephen.
What?
Not the podcast? Not that it was just 20-minute podcast, which is the shortest one we did.
Yeah, that was amazing in itself.
But it was a sort of the passion that you got into your. That was about a 12-minute monologue.
Yeah.
What do you know? What kicked that off?
I don't, Chris. No, it was obviously inside me, and it just needed a trigger. Maybe it's something I was always carrying around. I think some things like that. I do carry.
They were magic words, though. You know, I think if a parent or a prospective parent ever said to me, can you give me some guidance? I'd tell them to listen to that 12 minutes.
That's nice of you to say. I appreciate that. Thank you. I mean, I'm hoping that 12 minutes has a life of its own. I think it is unique amongst, you've identified it is a unique amongst the podcasts. And it's succinct and it's passionate. And it's what I've experienced. It's what I've experienced in my own life, own relationship with my father, which was highly problematic. And only in my later years did it become something like settled. My relationship with mother was always fine. And I miss her dearly. She died in 2009. But
do you think youngsters ever get over it? Like if they have traumatic... traumatic teenage years, which are very formative years, aren't they? Do you carry those years through your whole life, or is it true that they say time is a great healer? Does time heal?
Yeah, well, I wish I could say to you, for all the people out there listening to this who've had their own traumatic relationships with parents, I wish I could say to you that you do get over it.
Yeah.
It might be you do get over it, that is the hurt or the rejection or the pain or whatever it is, but you never forget it. It never leaves you. You're always with it. You have to find a place to put it, a box to put it in, and you just close that box and put that box somewhere secret, and you take it out. Now, the only reason why the reason why my box is open is because of the work I've done over two decades with gender identity and masculinity. There's no way I could do research at a high level into men and masculinity if I didn't explore my own masculinity. And it'd be impossible for me to explore my own masculinity if I didn't go back and explore my relationship with my parents in particular, especially my dad. So I had to deal with that early on. I'm talking early 90s. And afterwards, it became more easy for me. And I still harbored a lot of anger towards my dad. I mean, I can remember... It's only, I think, in the last 5-6 years that I've stopped having dreams fairly, not every week, but periodic dreams where I was really angry with my dad and physically fighting him in my dreams.
Yes.
And that signals, obviously, that I was dealing with some, unable to deal with some very unresolved anger towards him.
Yes.
Bitterness, I guess. But eventually those dreams stopped. And the things that, that for me, I'm not saying it would work for anybody else, but for me, the thing that enabled me to overcome that and go back to him and engage in a more easy way with my father was Buddhism. It just gave me the capacity and the tools to...
Buddhism the religion or Buddhism the philosophy?
Well, the philosophy, yeah.
Yeah?
Because it gave me the tools to forgive him and to forgive myself.
Yeah.
Because I think for a long time, the last time we had I remember in 19, what would it be, after Gavin was born, that year, 1974, we parted on a punch-up. Yeah, physically.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Physical punch-up, yeah.
Right.
And that had been a pattern over the years. Now, by then, I was 24 and a father. And I just, it was, a, it for me to be able to create my own identity meant I had to first challenge him, because he was not, I felt that he was not going to allow me to do that. I had to beat him. I had to beat him in this battle of wits against who was going to be dominant.
Yes.
Now, why he wanted to do that, that's another story. I mean, he was an institutionalized child, and he was in the Royal Navy for a long time, institutionalized. So I experienced an institutionalized with Forrest.
So the government had institutionalized your dad as well?
Yeah, that's right. And I ended up being the recipient of that. But in 1974, you know, we parted with that sort of anger and bitterness, and it was years later that before we got back together.
To follow that on a bit, what advice would you give to teenagers? There's something in the back of my mind that makes me think we've covered this before, but I'm going to ask the question again. What if you were a teenager now in a situation where you felt uncomfortable with the relationship with your mum and your dad? What coping strategies in that relationship can you pull in to survive? Because it sounds like is it survival until you're legally allowed to, you're legally able to leave home? Or
it is survival. There was one. I remember one moment in my life when I was about 16. I'd left school, and I was, although I had a problematic relationship, at times violent relationship with my father, albeit certainly not with my mother. I was working in the family business, so my whole life revolved around my family.
Yes,
everything. I had no escape from it. I was into music and pop groups at the time, and I was doing all that business. I had a circle of friends, which was very strong. But really, my life, I needed my father and mother in order to enable my life in many ways. And I remember one day, after a real bitter argument, fight that arose out of nothing at home, because my father was bad tempered and quick off to throw up, you know.
Yeah.
I just left the home, walked out of the house. It was a bitterly cold night. It was about probably December. And I just went to this field. There were some fields near the house, and I just lay down in the field. And I just didn't know what to do.
Yes.
I was really at the end of my tether. And I just laid down in the field. I thought, well, if I can die now, this will be good. Because if I can die, this pain's going to go away.
Yes.
I can't cope with it.
Yes.
Who am I going to go and talk to?
Yes.
And I was trapped. You know, I had to go back to the house. I had to go back to the work.
And who did you talk to? Did you talk to anybody?
Well,
because that's a coping strategy, isn't it? You find somebody outside the family that you can share. Is it? Well, I don't think it's folklore, is it? That a problem shared is a problem halved.
Absolutely.
You know,
but in that situation, my although I had this close relationship with my mother was also subject to my father's anger.
Yes.
So the whole family was walking on eggshells around my father's moods.
Yes.
And it was awful to live like that as you're growing up in puberty, not knowing what's going to kick off the following day or the following morning, what mood he's going to be in, if we're going to be violent, all this of it. Now, that particular night, I lay down in the field, just went wanting to die. I thought, this will be good. And it's cold, I can lay here, and that'll be it.
Yeah.
But, of course, I've got a very strong will, I've got a strong desire to live, and, you know, the cold got the better of me, and I got up and walked back to the house. So I go back in the house. I don't know what made me do it, and listeners might think this is a bit twee, but I'm not, at that time I was not religious, and it's only in the later years I've been drawn to Buddhism. I've never been drawn to Christianity. But I got my Bible out. I did have a Bible given to me by my grandmother.
Yes.
And I just, it was the only thing I could.
Yes.
I had nothing else. I'd been listening to music, but that wasn't working. I needed some words that were going to help me. So I went to my Bible, and I just say, well, okay, I'm going to open the Bible at whatever page and see what it says. I didn't read it very often. Didn't know it particularly well at all. So I opened it up, and what was it? It was Ecclesiasticals. Now, for those of you who are Christians, you'll know Ecclesiasticals. You know, everything comes to pass. That's embarrassing myself because I can't remember it. But it's there is a time for everything.
Yes.
A time for hurt, a time for pain, a time for pleasure, a time for all the rest.
Actually, that sounds like good advice.
It was good advice. And it was just letting me know that this is the time you've got to be in. It's not going to last. It's going to move on.
Yes.
It might move on next week or next year, but it's going to change.
Yes.
There's a time for this and a time for pain, a time for pleasure, a time for reaping and a time for sowing, a time for dying and a time for birth. Yes. And it was just wonderful advice. It was just so simple.
Yes.
But I just picked it up in the Bible and it was there. And that settled me.
So that's one of the coping strategies is religion, even if that religion only lasts for 10 minutes, right?
It's, I mean, there are some, the books there, you can...
What about the coping strategy where some teenagers go, okay, I'm going to make my bedroom my inner sanctum, and I'm basically going to separate myself from the factory. Is that healthy?
I don't think it's healthy, and we're seeing a lot of that now in Asia. There's a phenomenon called, in Japan particularly, but we're also seeing it in South Korea, and it's probably emerging in China. These are intensely competitive societies that have problematic, they have very few coping structures to deal with emotional turmoil.
Yes.
And what we're seeing is something called the hikikomori, and they're a group of males predominantly who retreat to the bedrooms for long periods of time. They don't physically come out of the bedrooms.
Is it Japanese, yes?
Predominantly Japanese, yes. And it started some years back.
What was the name again?
Hikikomori, right. Hikikomori, I think.
Yes.
People can Google it and find out more about it. But it's a spreading phenomenon. And what it is young males especially, probably from the age of 16 into the 20s, who are living at home, cut themselves off from society, cut themselves off from the family.
Do they cut themselves off from society because do they have internet? Is internet
well, they
their
do.
Connection
they're watching,
to the real world?
They're on the internet or they're watching television.
Yes.
And they are, but physically they're not coming out of the bedrooms.
Yes.
And it's a worry. There's a lot of research being now done on it in the universities in Southeast Asia especially. And that's one, if you like, coping strategy of dealing with the intense pressures that young people around the world are feeling.
Almost just ignoring it, separating yourself.
Almost,
from it, isolating yourself.
That's right, physically isolating yourself. I mean, it drives the parents mad because they can't get the child out the room unless it's to go to the toilet or bathroom. They're putting the food in through the door, the door's closed, and this goes on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah, I have a cartoon which I use in workshops sometimes when we're debating issues like this, and the workshop is very simple. The cartoon is very simple. It's the mum and dad are sat at their computer in their living room, and they're emailing their son saying, we haven't seen you for a while. Are you going to come down and say hello? And the contact is through email, even though he lives upstairs. And you know, there could be an element of truth to that. You know,
I think so. I mean, I know many young people now who are very computer literate and into social networking, and they're using the likes of Facebook and Twitter and whatever to communicate. And I think that's valid and it's fine. And it's a way of, if they can reveal themselves, if they can have close relationships online, then fine. If it's just casual and very surface, then it's not going to get, if the child or the young person has a problem, an emotional problem, emotional dilemma, then it might be that Facebook's not the place to reveal it and have it explored, and it's not going to be dealt with there. There needs to be, ideally, someone older, someone who can mentor them through the dilemma. Now, I didn't have anybody, but I did eventually have friends who were older. And that was a guide for me. It helped me a little bit, male and female, and just got into a network of people that took me through that very, very difficult period of puberty.
Yeah.
Now, one way I did escape it, and I wouldn't recommend it for everybody, and interestingly, my sister did the same. My sister and I both got married very young. My sister was married at 18.
And that's your lifeboat.
That was a lifeboat. I hate to say it, but it was. I met the first love of my life, Rosemary, when I was 21, and I had very few relationships prior to that. So I was 20 when I met her, and I was married at we got married at 21. My sister met her future husband when she was about 17, got married at 18.
Wow.
So we left, you see. Now, I was delighted to leave. I wanted my own home. I wanted to be an adult with my wife. And
yes.
So I was at 21, and that was wonderful.
Yes.
That was the start of my life proper. Up until then, I just felt I was bounded. I had little freedom. And
that's sad, because you're talking about 20% of your life.
Long time.
Aren't you? 20 years. Yeah. Let's say 20% of your life. That's a sad thing to sort of almost say, I'm glad I'm out of that.
I was glad. I was. You know, there were it wasn't, certainly my young childhood, was saved by the love of my mother and the love of a very important carer, what somebody I call Nana Howarth, who died unfortunately when I was 13. And without them, I think my life, certainly my adult life, would have been pretty miserable. With them, it was less miserable.
Yes.
But the puberty, I was saved by the puberty with friends. I was into music and all the rest of it. But the family life was not good. So to go and get married at 21 was a way out, and I was delighted to do it.
For some reason, the word Titanic is bouncing around inside my head.
Yeah.
So coping strategies, we were going to talk more about puberty. Maybe we'll get around to that. But let's stay on this. So if you're a teenager and you're in a family situation that is, because these are still relationships, right? So it still fits in with the relationship manifesto.
Sure.
Even though it's not adult relationships, it involves adults because it involves mum and dad.
Yeah.
So the coping strategies have religion. But it's interesting, the way you said it is religion doesn't have to be a full-time occupation, does it?
No.
You can actually sort of pull it in when it's needed, right?
I think religion's better if it's not a full-time occupation. Because if you're obsessed with religion and you're obsessed with every word of the Bible, that itself is a problem, because you're limiting yourself to a mindset, an ideology, an outlook on life, which is partial. And you don't... There might be some people say, well, the Bible can answer all the questions, and I've met people who claim that. Well, that may be the case, but sometimes I want to go out and find the answers for myself, and I might want to find them in some other place. I might want to find them in some other religion or in another way.
Yes.
I don't want someone to tell me this is what... You've got to look at this book in order to find your answer. You can't look anywhere else. I think that's just incredibly restricting and damaging, ultimately. I mean, I always worry about people who don't read anything but the Quran or don't read anything but the Bible. I mean, I think their knowledge base is so limited.
Mm.
Whatever the value of those particular books, how can anybody, the whole world is much bigger than any single book.
Yes.
Particularly today in the complex world we have today. So the religion's one way.
Okay, so part-time religion.
Part-time religion.
Put it in when you need it, boys and girls.
That's right. Yeah, don't be obsessed with it.
You know, even if you're using it 10 minutes every 10 years, you'll still get points up there in the cloud. And the cloud, as you know, in technology is very important now. I saw a wonderful cartoon today about Steve Jobs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a cartoon of Steve and he's up in the sky, standing on a cloud, and he's ringing Bill Gates saying, guess where I am? And of course the cloud is big, but that was a techie thing for the techno bubble crowd out there. Religion, ignoring the problem and isolating yourself is another one, but it's saying it's one that you feel it's not a healthy one.
I don't think so. I mean, ultimately you've got to confront it. Now, I didn't confront the problem I had with my father until I was in my 40s, and I was doing first an MA and then a PhD, and because I was looking at I got drawn into feminist theory, and that feminist theory got me to drew me into
what age? What age?
42, okay, 43, 44. Yes, yes. And that drew me into gender, and gender talk, of course, took me into men and masculinities. So looking at men and masculinities, it was inevitable at some point in that process I was going to have to look at my own masculinity, and that, as I say earlier, drew me to my father's relationship.
Yes.
So I didn't deal with that, if you like, until I was in my when 40s.
Yes.
A long time.
Okay. So anyway, there's a sort of let's ignore it; it'll go away principle.
Yeah.
There's I love the next one, which the next one is get married as soon as you can, because that will get you out of it. But is that a dated solution now? Because nowadays that maybe. You're talking about 40 years ago, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
So is it something that would no longer apply now?
You won't see much of it now. You know, marriage is not only less frequent, less common. It's incredibly less common for people in their 20s. When I say to anybody, even in Thailand, even Thais here, and tell them I got married at 21, they look at me aghast. They look at me with surprise.
Yes.
And yet, in my age, in my era and your era, in the 60s, it was highly common. Many, many people got married 19, 20, 21, 22. Yes. Now, if I say to a 22-year-old person, I got married when I was 21, they look at me crazy.
Mm.
But I learned a lot from that. The marriage forced me to mature quickly. I had to have a house, and we, within a few years, I had a child, and I had to be responsible. And I welcomed it. I was ready for it. I wanted to leave the nest. The nest for me was not a very comfortable place. I wanted to build my own nest. For those of you feel likewise, I suggest that you can still do that. You just don't necessarily have to get married.
Mm.
You can go and live with someone. We see a lot of that today.
Just buy the book and make sure you read the
last chapter. Just buy the Relationship Manifesto book and follow the vows. You won't need to get married.
Interesting. It's in my, again, in my head is bouncing around that solution has changed from becoming the lifeboat to actually becoming the Titanic itself.
Well, that's right. I mean, even though I was delighted, I engaged at 20. Got engaged to my future wife within 6 months of meeting her. I engaged to be married, made a commitment to be married, and was married about 12 months after that. We did get divorced when we were in our 30s. We were both about 35, 36 when we got divorced. But do we look back on that with regret? Absolutely no. We had 16 great years.
Yes.
And Rosemary is a very close friend of mine, as I am of hers, and we're regularly in communication. She found another love that's been incredibly important in her life. Mm. I've gone on and had my various journeys and experiences. But we have that Gavin in common, our eldest son, my eldest son, and we have that period together.
Yes.
And that'll never go away, and it's very precious. Yes. So it didn't just because we got married at 21, the idea we were going to be together at 81. No.
Yeah.
I never really thought that, even in those early days when I didn't understand relationships. The idea of being together for 60 years, and I was faithful with Rosemary. Listeners may be surprised, but I mean, I didn't play at all. I was in a completely monogamous relationship.
Well,
for
I should hope
years.
So too. You know.
Yeah. Well.
Okay. So, I'm asking you questions about advice to give to a teenager, and I know that the Relationship Manifesto. You know, I don't forget that we have an adult audience. They were all kids at one time.
Yeah. Sure.
You pointed out before, and. Yeah. And they may all be mums and dads in the future, even if they're not now. So any others? I noticed when your first three wasn't have a really good friend you confide in. Now, is that because teenagers don't have really good friends?
I do worry that teenagers rely overly on social networking and the internet and all that comes with that.
Electronic social networking.
I'm not convinced that can replace a real-time person where you're together and you're sitting together and you're sharing a beer or whatever it is you share, someone you can ring up and talk to and cry with and all the rest of it. I think you need both. I can see the value of the wider social networking, but the idea of having 500 friends on Facebook and no one to talk to when you're feeling lonely, that's bizarre.
Yes.
So one can't replace the other. Maybe for young people who have both, that's very rich and rewarding. You need someone to talk to. You need someone you can phone, you can talk.
But do teenage... I'm desperately trying to think back to when I was a teenager, and did I have somebody that I'd really confide in? And I'm not sure that I actually did. No, maybe it's just I can't remember. Do you...
No, I understand that point. I don't think I did.
Is that a general thing with teenagers, you think? There's somebody... Well, teenagers are always on their guard because there's peer pressure involved here and fitting in with the crowd.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely. I mean, that's why I said...
boys don't cry.
It's powerful. That's why I said in the podcast last week, you know, you become a parent pal, so you want the child to relate to you. I mean, I talk very openly with my two youngest children, and I did with my eldest and my 18-year-old. They will talk to me about pretty much anything. And it's particularly the areas if they've got problems at school, if they're feeling unhappy or they've got relationship problems or sex problems, they talk to me. I mean, my 15-year-old son emailed me, although I live in Thailand and he lives in the UK. He emailed me some months ago asking me, should he have sex with this young girl he was going out
with? Should we be saying this publicly?
Yeah, but he did, and he wasn't sure.
Yeah,
he wasn't really ready for sex at that time, and this girl he was going out with as a friend wanted sex with him. You're about the same age, and he said, "Dad, you know what? How do I reject her? What do I say to her to make her feel okay so that she won't? Because I don't want to have sex. I'm not ready for it."
But you must be feeling quite good that your son can come and confide in you
in
that way.
I was taken aback, to be honest. Yeah. I was a bit surprised. Because we haven't had a lot of physical contact, but I'm there on the phone. I mean, I've been in, as you know, I've been living in Thailand full time since 2009,
right.
And not going back to the UK very often, though seeing my kids when I do go back. So when my son, that particular son, emailed me, yeah, it was a bit of a surprise, but I'd recognised that I'd, in the moments when I was communicating with him on the phone,
yes,
albeit at 7,000 miles away,
yes,
I was making the necessary emotional connections. I was asking him the right questions. And I was, whatever I was doing, it was allowing him to feel comfortable, to trust in me so he could open up. And he opened up in the email. Now, I know, subsequent to that, I know a lot of detail about his sex life, and I know what he's done and who he's done it with. And we've talked about condoms and protection and emotional.
He's now 17. How old is he now?
16.
16.
And now, with a boy, there's a lot of male father stuff that can go on. You know, I'm not in competition with my son. I am very open, as you know, and the listeners will know, I'm very open about these sorts of
Does
subjects.
Does that happen with sons and dads?
I think it's unusual. I think, yes.
No,
I think
the competition aspect, not the
I think the competition aspect. I think many fathers feel uneasy when their own son emerges as a sexual being and is going out and having sex and having relationships and living a life that maybe that father regrets they can't do, because maybe they're in some monogamous relationship that doesn't allow that to happen. With girls, with daughters, it's more problematic. But then again, when my daughter, she's only 15 now, I don't, if she's having sex, she's not told me. But what she does say to me, and I know she dates in a very casual way some older boys, what she does say to me, well, I don't allow anything to happen that I'm not comfortable with. And I will read that in whatever way I want. I know that my particular daughter is a very strong character, and she wouldn't allow anything to happen that she wasn't comfortable with. As long as she can talk to me about any situation, her emotions, then that I can't do any more as a father. So they know that I'm at the end of an email, I'm at the end of a phone. And often, maybe that's the distance helps. If I was waking up in the morning and they were there at breakfast table, or you know, watching television together all through the day, maybe it wouldn't work. I don't know. Maybe it works because I'm at a physical distance. I know that it's not easy for parents who have got the hands-on effort of raising a teenager or parenting a teenager. It's very hard to have that free-flowing trust and emergent connection with a young adult, because you're too busy wanting to get them off to school or making sure they do their homework.
Yes,
or don't spend too much time on the computer, or you're worried if they're into drugs, or you know, all this stuff.
Yes,
I have the luxury of not having that on an everyday basis. It's my ex-partner has that, and I recognise that she has that emotional labour, physical labour, and I respect her for it.
Yes,
so I see myself acting in a support capacity, not to replace her work, because she does far more than I do, but to operate in the support capacity for her, so my children have a male that they can, an adult male they can relate to, and if they want to share sex and relationships and issues about, you know, school or whatever, they can.
Yes,
I can't. That's all I can do, really.
So the fourth coping the fourth coping strategy, if you're a youngster at home and we're feeling uncomfortable, is if you can have a really good friend. But you've actually said yourself, you know, the best solution is if your parents become your really good friends, you've cracked it, haven't you?
In fact,
the parents have cracked it.
The parents have cracked it and the kids have cracked it. That's the wonderful thing, because you've got it immediately. You've got a friend on site.
Yes.
You don't have to go looking for the friend, and the friend loves you. As long as that friend can be non-judgmental, can be supportive, can offer advice when needed, and just say nothing when sometimes.
Yes.
Just let the things happen.
Yes.
Because you have to recognise, I mean, I found, for me, the period from about 13 to 18 was a difficult time. Aspects of it were quite horrid. I didn't enjoy it. Other aspects were lovely, but mostly lovely when I wasn't near my father, when I wasn't in the home setting, when I felt freer.
Yes.
Children need to experience that freedom. They need to be able to come and find themselves and explore and experiment. So the parents of those become increasingly those in a support capacity.
Okay, let's move into what we originally were going to talk about, which was puberty. That, I think this is a really good. I think what we've done in the last 30 minutes is a really good follow up to that session we had in the last, or you had in the last session, yep. In the last podcast. But we started off the last podcast. It was going to be about puberty, and it was good because. I like what you said before, because you said one thing I'm sure about everybody that's listening to this is they went through it, right? And that's that's something that binds everybody that's listening here on here. And but that's an interesting thing: is how do you help children through that? Do you leave a copy of a book next to the bed and hope that the son or daughter picks it up? Things have changed since our time, though, I think, Stephen, because back in the UK in the last two summers, the explicitness of some of the TV sex education programmes, I've just been amazed at. Channel 4 in the UK had some amazing programmes. And they were challenging stereotypes of things like being gay. Here's four guys on the stage naked. I just couldn't believe it. Who do you think's the gay one? And of course they all went for the stereotype physical gay one. And bless their hearts, in Channel 4, of course they'd chosen it so that wasn't the gay person, just to try and make the note. And I think that's changed since our day, hasn't it? Because it's talked about now, which 40 years ago it.
Well, 40 years ago, certainly in the early 60s, it was a crime to be gay. They were locking gays up, and they were putting young single women who had babies outside of marriage, they were putting them in mental homes.
Yes.
So we moved on a long way.
But just general sex education, rather than, not just that stereotype.
The sex education I had at school, which didn't amount to very much, I have to say. I left school when I was 15. It was a local GP who came in and talked endlessly about syphilis. Just to scare the living daylights out of us. And that was it. This was long before the era of AIDS, of course. Just talked endlessly about syphilis and gonorrhea.
Really?
Yeah. It didn't account to any more than that. And I often wondered, it seemed to me that GP sometimes was a bit inebriated. It was a bit drunk when he came into school anyway. So
that was his coping strategy.
That was his coping strategy.
Stand up in front of a group of kids.
But it was, the sex education was pretty non-existent. Of course, a lot more formalised and organised and professional now. But the big questions that a young person is asking at puberty that we may go on to ask later on in life, but they're particularly profound between the ages of 13 and 18 because we don't have any reference points. We may have a parents, but we do want to grow out from our parents. We don't want to emulate our parents. We don't want to be clones of our parents. Very few people want that. We want to explore what we can be. So the questions are this. I mean, there's a big question about identity, which is, who am I? We don't really know, 13, 14, who we are. Then there's a sexual identity, is what am I? Gay, lesbian, it's a lot of pressure to be heterosexual. Compulsory heterosexuality operates pretty much universally. So anybody who's got that sexual identity that's starting to form outside of that compulsory heterosexual model is in a risk zone, unless they're in a very supportive environment.
Yes.
Then there's the existential question that probably most of us hang on to in some way, which is why? Just why am I here? What's the purpose of all this? There's the future question about where am I going? Because you've got all that future mapped out. When you're 18... The 30-year-old looks ancient, and the 60-year-old is unimaginable, really. And there's the material question, which I think is pushed very, very hard nowadays, and that's, how do I do it? Where do I get the money from?
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to live? How am I going to go to university? How am I going to afford it? So we're asking people, we're asking young people to grow up very quick. Childhood is being condensed into, no more than 10 years, which is a shame. And the loss of innocence that obviously comes with the end of childhood is part of this issue of young people growing up too quickly or being forced to assume responsibilities, drop into the real world, pressures for education, results, attainment, all down to competition with peers, and the child themselves is under pressure to be liked, to have a socialisation, to be part of a group, a peer group. I'm not talking about family, but what's more important for most 15-year-olds is not the family liking them, but their friends liking peers, them, peers, yes. Peer group association. Avoiding feelings of loneliness, which is pretty much impossible. Most teenagers will feel that at some point. But loneliness itself is probably not such a bad thing. But in a very acute situation where that child feels isolated and alone, that can lead to depression. And it can then, in very extreme cases, lead to suicide. And we've seen plenty of evidence of young people committing suicide under those emotional pressures. So educational pressures, family expectations, competing with peers, and of course competing with siblings, your elder brother or sister. Your elder brother or sister's gone off to university, you're expected to follow, you're finding it not quite as easy, you're not quite as motivated. Where does that leave you? You're looking at the failure in the family, all this sort of stuff.
It's those horrible words, isn't it? Why can't you do as well as your brother?
Yeah, absolutely. You say that to a child. Your parents, what?
Yes.
Where does that leave the child? I mean, a question like that could hang with that child for years.
Yes.
Long after they've got married and had kids of their own, they're still hanging on this.
Yes.
I've come across adults who still feel, no matter what they've achieved in life, adults who've been very successful still feel failures because they've never had that appreciation from the parents. And parents have never said simply, I love you and I think you're great. I think what you're doing is superb. Even if it's that superb, we appreciate. We love you for who you are.
Yes.
And we give you support. And we don't judge you against some artificial larger social code or expectations. Yes. We're going to love you if you get to Oxford University with 3 A's.
Yeah, we'll love you more.
We'll just love you more, yeah. If you end up somewhere else or don't even go to university, and not going to love you anymore. It's a nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah.
These artificial expectations. But there's pressures, and I think that young people today are under increasing pressure, and I don't envy them.
Yes.
But it's, for me, as an educationist, it's been very rewarding working with young people, and I particularly like to work with the 17, 18 plus. I've worked in further education colleges and universities for many years, and that age group is an interesting one because then they're coming out of puberty, they're starting to form their own identity. The big questions are still there, sexual identity, bigger personal identity and character. But certainly the young people at 18, 19 are getting more confidence, and yes. It's not necessarily they're going down a good path. Some of them don't, They can get caught up in the judicial system, particularly if they get into drugs and petty crime. But whatever the kid gets caught up in, the parent's got to be the rock.
Yeah. You said that you felt that childhood was being compressed. It wasn't as long as it used to be. And I feel very sad about that.
Yeah.
At MIT, they have a very well-known department there for doing sort of educational research and with EdTech as well. And they have a sign up, and I might not get it quite right, but they have a sign up on their wall which pronounces them as being the lifelong kindergarten. And I love that approach. They want to be experimental. Yeah. They want to try it, suck it and see. Does it work? Does it not work?
Yeah.
And, I'd love to see childhood last longer. And there are times, and take this as you will, where, people say, oh, that's a bit childish. Even at my age, and to be honest, when somebody says that, I say, "Oh, thank God for that."
It's a good response, actually.
If I lost that childhood enthusiasm,
well, that's right. True.
I would turn into what my wife's acronym is, a BOF.
Boring old.
Yes, very close with a and God forbid that happened. If the spark goes, that's very sad. Life's too short already.
It is. Well, one of the things I see in society, not so much here in Asia, but I certainly see it in the UK and America, is families that are being brought up without a father presence at all. Now, I think single mothers fine. There's no quality difference between for a child if it's brought up in a loving environment, whether it's a loving environment with two parents, a loving environment with one parent. Far better to be brought up in a loving environment with one parent than a non-loving environment with two parents.
You've said that before many times, actually, haven't you?
Yeah. So you have a situation whereby maybe the one parent is a woman, and she's bringing up one or more children. The father still has to play a role. But in many parts of society, we don't see those fathers playing any role whatsoever, and they just disappear completely and have no contact with the kids and provide no support for the mother. In that situation, that's a problem, because what happens is, by the time the young boy gets to puberty, particularly an issue for men, for young boys rather than for girls, but the boy has no male elder figure that it can relate to. So you have this gap, you have this absence of a reference model for that young boy who's developing his own masculinity, under pressure with peers, to behave in certain ways, follow certain codes of behaviour, and the young men can become very, very rebellious, very, very angry inside,
But all the time they're being bombarded with from media and from advertising agencies to try and fit a particular model. Does that not have a big influence on
the kids? I think it does. And, you know, the media can reinforce, wittingly or unwittingly, can reinforce negative expectations, particularly around young ethnic minority men, boys, you know, where they behave in a certain way. I remember when teachers have got to be aware of this, but not slipping into stereotypes, because you've got a young black or Asian boy in your class is problematic in some way in terms of behavior or low attainment, that, you know, you automatically assume that's because they are black or Asian,
that ethnic group. Yes,
that ethnic group.
Yes.
So you've got to deal with people on an individual basis, and the only way I've seen that happen effectively, deal with that particular model effective, that particular problem effectively, is if you create mentors. And I think I may have said it on another podcast, but I worked with a guy called Richard Rages.
I remember.
And he was good at that, because he set up a mentoring scheme for these young boys in Manchester, as it happened to be. And these were lads in the gang culture, the city gang culture. And they had older men that they could relate to who guided them, who were there at the end of a phone or around the street corners, who were a boundary, a gate between a life almost of crime in some cases.
Yes.
And those mentors we need more.
Mm.
That would be something I'd say to the government and in the States. You provide
Didn't your example as well, didn't your mentor actually grow out of the gang culture? Was that the one you were telling me about? So, you know,
if you grow out of
the gang culture they've
been in it
themselves. Have some credibility.
Sure, they have some credibility. They know the language. They know the street. They've got street cred.
Yeah.
And they've sometimes they've been inside, they've been in prison themselves, they've been caught in the judicial system, they've come out of that, and they're putting something back positive back into society.
Yes.
And, you know, these people are highly, vitally important. Yes. And if they work alongside the teachers, the education system and the social system, then that can be an important network. But all they're doing, really, in effect, is being forced to replace an absent father.
Yes.
If you had a positive male figure, ideally the father.
Yes.
It doesn't need to be biological father, it can be stepfather, that's fine. And if you've got that, then the mentors themselves are not needed.
I think this episode is going to be called The Teenage Years rather than Puberty now. We sort of meandered around the topic a bit, didn't we?
Yeah.
It's a sort of episode where you need a glass of wine late at night and listen to it. Because I still don't know what the solution is as far as educating your son and daughter with puberty. You know, schools, some of them abdicate that responsibility to schools, don't they?
I think schools are ill-equipped to deal with it. I think
ill-equipped.
Absolutely. Yes. Let me qualify that. I think many schools have the skills in the teaching force to deal with it. But the schools now are caught up in other dilemmas. They've got to meet targets. They've got to...
Hang on, we're at 44 minutes.
Right, 44.
I can see you're on another 44-minute podcast
already.
But
if you've got that culture where the teachers are forced to teach in a very prescriptive, narrow way, in order to get the child or children through targets, which then reflect well on the school in the league table.
Yeah.
Where's the space for that to take in time out with one rather disruptive male or female that needs particular support? Now, I know schools can do it, and I know as many good schools around that do it very well, but it is asking a lot, and the resources are not often there to do it properly. Mm. And often the schools are not, it's not recognised as a skill, you know. So this is all part of this larger intensification of teenagerdom, if you like, the pressures on being a teenager. I mean, it's hard time, and you know, the work's not there, the threat of redundancy or not having a job at all is there, the high costs of going to university.
Now, this is too much doom and gloom for me. It's I want to look at the golden lining. There must be something. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're a husband or wife, just send your children to puberty.com. I'm sure there'll be an answer there. I bet there is a website called puberty.com.
No doubt. I mean, there's a lot of good information on the web. That's one of the benefits, isn't it, of the last 15 years of technological change. Yeah, you can Google it. There will be advice, I'm sure.
I'd love to know the statistics on how many kids actually, you know, when mum and dad eventually get up to the point where they say, well, we should tell our son about the birds and the bees which is a strange thing to say, actually, birds and bees, because they don't mate, do they, together? And I'd love to know the statistics on when they've got to that point and they call little Johnny or Janet in, and how many of the kids say, sorry, mum and dad, I moved through that area about 3 years ago.
Yeah, they didn't realise it. Yeah, so that's
and that's a coping strategy for parents, isn't it? If you wait long enough, it will sort itself out.
Many parents hope that does happen, I think. Yeah. They'll learn by default.
Yeah.
Interesting. Did you learn by default, Chris?
But I wonder what age they start to learn, though. That's the thing.
Well, what age did you start to learn?
Well, I'm not sure whether I've got there yet. I'm a big fan of this term, which used to be a cliche, lifelong learning.
Mm.
To be honest, and I don't think I'll ever stop learning. Well, and it doesn't matter what the topic is.
Yeah,
I don't think, and I hope I never stop learning.
Well, I thought I knew a lot, and then I came out to Thailand.
Yes,
and then I came out, and then I met. Then I thought I knew even more, and then I met Ali Taylor, and I realised I didn't know very much at all. So you just carry on learning. My journey continues.
And I hope it does, and I hope that spark stays with people until the very end. And then you pick up your Bible again and hope the very end isn't the very end.
Yeah,
right?
Well,
maybe we'll stop there. That's nearly 50 minutes again. We went around that topic, and I write minutes up of this meeting and send them round to the staff room. Oh no, sorry, that's another meeting. We haven't decided what we're going to do next week, have we? And maybe we should think about, but we'll make a decision before next week. Maybe we've gone through, over the last three or four podcasts, we've actually taken a chronological approach to relationships. And we might want to jump forward to something like even menopause or years.
There's a podcast to be made on the 20-year-olds going into the first significant sexual relationships, emotional relationships, love relationships. That's one area, the early 20s, and what are the implications there. Then there's certainly another one. There's one for the 40s, men and women in the 40s, and then there's certainly one for men and women in the 50s. And I think we can certainly talk about that latter one, because that is that would take us to the other end of the spectrum. And I think it's helpful, because I know we've got many listeners in that age group, and that is increasingly an age group that is out there, and for the first time probably in history, and I say that, I don't say that lightly, but the first time in history we've got the 50-year-olds going out there and experimenting in their sexual identity, because throughout history, you know, many societies, we didn't live that long.
Yes.
We were dead.
It's difficult to experiment if you're dead.
Yeah, you're dead by the time you got to 50 anyway, but in most cases, now people are going on living to the 70s, 80s.
Okay, so maybe we'll continue this chronological theme and pick up on some areas over the next two or three podcasts, maybe.
Yeah, sure.
It makes some sense. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the normal reminder, it's like the health warning on the end, on the side of a packet of cigarettes. The health warning on the side of this packet of relationship manifestos is the blog is at relationshipmanifesto.posterous.com. You can see all the archives, or 35 other episodes, and also there's the opportunity for you to comment
And don't worry about if you commented on an episode that went out 4 months ago. We still get notified about when you do that by email, so they won't get lost. So if you do it, Stephen, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
And next week we'll both put on a few more years, and
I
was thinking we can go from the short trouser era to the long trouser era.
Okay. Okay.
Talk to you again all later. Thanks for listening.
This recording is part of a Relationship Manifesto podcast series with Chris Smith and Stephen Whitehead.